Act as if you're the man. Act as if you're, you know, you have $1 million in your pocket. Act as if, you know, you're the best broker in the world.
You're stepping into the ring with two guys who pull no punches. This is Entrepreneur Showdown.
Happy Monday morning, everybody. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Showdown, home of the pull no punches, take no crap entrepreneur interviews. I am Dan Franks. Joe Cassandra, my partner in crime, coming on shortly. And also coming on in the main event today, Tom Morcus from TomMorcus.com. We'll talk about making connections with some of those big name people that you're trying to reach out to and trying to network with and trying to build relationships with. Tom has mastered that art. So we'll talk to Tom about that in today's main event. If you want to let us know how we're doing, let us know what you think of the show. You can go to showdownlove.com and give us your feedback. And of course, for the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more, you can head on over to entrepreneurshowdown.com. But with that, let's get on with the showdown.
Round one.
We have an interesting round one. This is going to be a little different than what we usually do. For this round one, we're actually going to talk about a project that our own Dan Franks is working on with some other people in the podcast space. And it's something that they put together. And when you think about, when you start hearing all this stuff from people, from you hear in the past interviews, you hear, hey, just start taking action and whatnot. And it's all great talk. And you could say to yourself, yeah, I'll take action when something comes along. But they had an idea, and they jumped on it, and they took action immediately. And you're going to hear the crazy story that's just happened in like the past couple days. And I'm not even going to hold the suspense any longer. Dan, tell them what's going on, and then tell them what's been going on with Kickstarter, because that's a crazy story that's been going on.
Well, just to lead into it a little bit, something that we've discussed a few weeks ago was the idea of idea validation. And we mentioned that it was for a project that I was working on, and that you had really pushed me and encouraged me to try to figure out some ways to validate this idea that we had. And the whole idea, we didn't disclose it at the time, but the whole idea we had was to form a national podcast conference. You know, similar to like your new media expos or things like this that reach a whole lot of niches or a whole lot of areas with blogging and web TV. But the idea we had was to do something specifically for podcasting. And a few weeks ago when I pitched that to you, or a few months ago, I guess, whenever I pitched that to you, your whole idea thing was, well, that sounds great, but you have to figure out a way to validate it. You have to figure out a way to make sure this is something that people want. Because it's easy for people to say, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. But when push comes to shove, if they're not willing to put their money where their mouth is, then the idea is no good, because that's, you know, it takes money to do all anything. So that kind of conversation that we had then led into this project, and it's called Podcast Movement, and it's a national podcasting conference. And like you talked about back then, and what you mentioned now was, we're using Kickstarter, and that was our way to validate the idea. We decided, if we want to do this conference, let's set a date at some point, say 6 or 7 months in the future, and let's run the first month of that as a Kickstarter campaign and put some number value, some monetary value on it. So not necessarily the full cost of what this project was going to cost us, but some specific amount that we thought, if we can collect this amount of money from people buying, you know, doing a pre-sale to this event, if we can get that amount of money pledged to this idea, then that's our validation right there. And that's our whole putting the money where the mouth is and proof of concept. So that's where the Kickstarter comes in. And just in 48 hours since we've launched the Kickstarter, maybe even less, we've far exceeded our goal. So our goal was 11,000 for the whole 30-day term was what we were going for. And thus far in 48 hours, we've gotten to over 16,000. So we've surpassed our goal by 5,000 and still have 27 days left or something like that.
Yeah, I'm looking at the numbers right now as of February 15th in the evening, and they're already at $16,000, and this is in 2 days. So, and I'm just to, I guess, put a disclosure, Kickstarter is not some sort of get-rich campaign or anything like that. There was a lot of thought that went into just the just the sales page, because I mean, here's the background of all this. Like Dan mentioned, like when you if you're a podcaster and you hear, oh, a podcasting conference, that sounds great, but there's other platforms going on, like New Media Expo, which we've talked about, and the whole idea that I was kind of coming from when I was thinking, hey, they need to kind of validate this, because it costs money to put on a conference, of course, is, are you going to get people to not spend money, because everyone can't go to every conference, that's a fact. Are you going to get people to not spend money at this conference and instead spend their money to come and travel to your conference? And you're not just paying for the ticket. And we knew this, and we figured this out when we came back from Vegas. You're not just paying for the tickets. You're paying for the hotel. You're paying for food while you're there. You're paying for
all the shenanigans.
All the shenanigans adds up to a lot more than what you think it will. And so that's what this whole idea was. It wasn't to try and get a quick buck off a Kickstarter. It was to see, are people willing to spend money to go to this conference rather than maybe one other one? Because I know, at least for me, like, I don't have time to go to 50 conferences a year. I can only go to one or two. Am I going to spend my money going to this one, or am I going to spend my money going to another one? And so Dan, he spent a ton of time working on just the landing page, just the sales page, to get people interested enough to want to put their money down. And when they put their money down, that means ideas being validated right away, and it's not like people are just buying the cheap shit. They're buying the top. I'm looking at the tiers. There's like six different tiers, and the top three or four of them, not the biggest one, but the other ones below it, they're all sold out already. So, I mean, that's a huge idea of validation right there.
Yeah, and I 100% full credit to you for even this project making it to Kickstarter at all, which now looking back, I couldn't imagine doing it any other way, because as we keep saying, that was the ultimate idea validation, was forcing people to pay for something that they said they were willing to pay for. And, you know, you didn't necessarily suggest specifically Kickstarter, but you just pushed and pushed and pushed. There's got to be some way to validate. Any idea can be validated somehow. And that kind of sent me and Jared Easley and Gary Leland, who are working on this with me, that kind of pushed us all back to the drawing board. And like, okay, Joe's right here. This sounds great to the three of us, but who else does it sound great to? And just being forced to go back and reevaluate things and go back and push it to Kickstarter, that right there was a huge mindset shift for us. And then, like you said, the whole process of crafting what that Kickstarter was going to look like, and crafting the sales page and the wording. And it was really a team effort, because you helped me, Joe. Some of the speakers helped me, really reading through this copy and really evaluating it and criticizing it. And there was some harsh comments about some of the just simple wordings that we had on that sales page. People look at things. Everyone looks at things differently. And kind of the lesson I learned is, when you write something, if you really want it to work and you really want it to appeal to your target audience, you have to be open to getting criticism from outside people. Because when I write something, I think it's good, obviously, because I wrote it. They're my words. It's my way of wording things. It's what I think is just right. But when you start reaching out to other people, whether it's your target audience, some of those people, you know, coworkers, partners like you, just anybody that can read something just from a different point of view, there might be somebody read something and it was just one little sentence. So I've got this, you know, 2,000 word copy, and one little sentence, he says, this right here is going to turn off a lot of people, and here's why. And you know what? The tonality of that one sentence really did kind of create, it was very aggressively worded for no reason. You know, it didn't come off that way to me. But when someone presented it to me that way, then all of a sudden I thought of it outside the box. And so I think my big takeaway from this that I'll take going forward is to really, really, really put a lot of focus and a lot of effort into getting outside opinions on any kind of thing I'm doing like this.
Yeah. So I know you had an original draft that you had written. And like you said, I had looked at it. A lot of other people looked at it. But you said after you got all that feedback, you totally scrapped it. So what was going wrong in that first one that you just scrapped it and did it again?
Well, so writing the copy for this first sales page, and when I say sales page, this is really, you know, the story on Kickstarter is what it is, the story you're telling to get people to donate money to the Kickstarter campaign. And it was, like I said, written from my point of view. And a lot of it was because I was so deep in the weeds of this conference. You know, you sometimes you can't see the forest from the trees is what the saying is. So I was on the inside so much that I could maybe skip some things that to me didn't seem like a big deal, but to the reader, it might have been very important information. Since I inherently knew that information, it was hard for me to kind of verbalize that and put it on the page. But when someone else said, hey, you're leaving out a big part here, or why are you just assuming people know X or Y when it's not out there, you're just assuming people know what you're talking about already. And really, like I said, just removing myself from myself to be able to read it as a party that has no familiarity with the project at all, and they're reading it cold and trying to understand what's going on, that was a big thing. So when I did that and I kind of went through that exercise of trying to remove myself from my body and read it as an outside party, that really, you know, it was eye-opening for me. And I did. I scrapped the whole thing and I reassembled it. And some of the wording was the same and some of the paragraphs might have been the same, but I completely shifted everything around and I think kind of honed in on what the true important parts were. And I chopped out a lot too. There was a lot of things going on there that weren't important. And I wouldn't have been able to do that on my own. That's what I'm saying. It takes other eyes, other sets of eyes, other minds to look at things.
Yeah. And I mean, like I mentioned, I got to see the first draft, and the draft that you see right now is excellent because it adds in not just great graphics and whatnot, because it didn't have all that before. All the Kickstarter reward pictures, all the keynote speakers, which there's an impressive lineup, which you all have to go see. We'll definitely link it up. But then also just in the copy, it's making people care about why should they care about this? Because first of all, if they want to go to the conference, people are always thinking about what's going to be in it for them. Why should they care about going? And then second, especially with something like Kickstarter, I mean, you're giving up money to something that you haven't even seen the full product yet. You don't know what to expect. It hasn't been done before. So you have to build a certain trust factor as well into getting them to give up, to part with their money. And I mean, in 48 hours, raising $16,000, I mean, you'll have to the listeners definitely have to go check out the copy and see how there's a trust factor building in there. And like I said, if you can get people to part with their money, especially this early on, then, I mean, you've definitely validated the idea, but you're also making people care about that idea as well.
Yeah, and I know we're up against it here, and I'll let you wrap it up after real quick. But if you do want to see that copy and what that page looks like, it's at podcastmovement.com. And from what I understand, Kickstarter keeps all projects up there into perpetuity. So no matter when you're listening to this, this project will be on Kickstarter. And I think we should, you know, as the course, you know, throughout the course of this project developing, we can have different segments talking about, you know, how we made Kickstarter work and different launch and pre-launch strategies, because this has allowed me to kind of open my eyes to Kickstarter. And there's not a lot of conferences that are being funded on Kickstarter, but that doesn't mean there shouldn't be. It just really hasn't been done in our space before. So I think there's a lot of different lessons that can be learned along the way of this process that we can, you know, share as we go.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is going a little longer than round one, but this is an exciting time. And I guess just a very last point is this conference also, there was a lot of people who we had built connections with before, or people knew people. There was a lot of networking that went on behind the scenes to kind of bring this guest list together, to bring on some sponsors and whatnot. And that's just to kind of, and I just mentioned that just to reiterate the importance of, hey, you may be, if you're doing something online, yeah, you may be doing some great stuff behind the computer, but you need to get out and meet some people. If you have an offline type venture, make sure you're going to meetups and whatnot and meeting like-minded people, because those like-minded people, you're going to need them later on. And I know, I'm sure Dan can vouch that a lot of it came about because the guest list, some of the sponsors, was because people knew each other and people had those connections, and that really helped get it off the ground so fast.
Yeah, well, I can definitely say that even though everybody that are a lot of people at podcasts, it's an online game. You know, you do online interviews, or even you or I, even though we live in the same city, we're doing this in two separate locations. So there's a lot of online relationships that are built amongst podcasters and online entrepreneurs and all these things. But I can undoubtedly say that 100% of our 30 plus speakers, one of the people working on the project know personally or have met personally, you know, whether it's the keynote speakers or whether it's some of the session leaders between, you know, us three that are working on the project. We all, at least one of us, know every single person personally. So it's interesting because, like I said, this is an online space with a lot of online communication and relationships. But at the end of the day, that person-to-person connection is invaluable.
Yep. I just wanted to reiterate that because it's so important, especially in the online world, you need to build those connections, especially early on, if you want to build something great, which is what they're doing right now. But we've had a great discussion with that. Let's get on to round two.
Round two.
For round two today, we're looking at an article by Tom Morkus. He was introduced to us by our friend David Hutcherson over at The Power of Part-Time TV. So thank you, David. And we'll talk more with Tom about what he's up to, because he's up to a lot of different things. But he wrote an interesting article because he just started his own publishing company just recently called Insurgent Publishing. And the way he kicked it off is he has this group project with a lot of A-list names from the online world, especially the business world, like John Lee Dumas, Pat Flynn, Chris Guillebeau. And he wrote this post because a lot of people are asking him, how the heck did you get all these people? Because you, Tom, are somewhat of not a huge name as some of these people. So how did you get these people to contribute to your book? And I don't even think they're taking a profit from it. And he gives a couple of steps on how he was able to do that. And I mean, I've heard tips like this before about, hey, get a roundup post and get a bunch of big names because they're all shared and whatnot. Have you heard stuff like that, Dan?
Yeah, there's a couple different things you can do, and we've done as well, to really build connections and get people to help you create content. Because as Tom says in multiple places, he's not some world-renowned author. He's not some master curator of content. So what he has to do is start building connections with people to then leverage those connections to create content. And that's really what he did here. And he goes through the steps of how he did make connections, and that's his very first step, and it's step four on this article. But then in that step, he describes how it should really be step zero, because in order to leverage anyone else's time and resources, you really need to have some kind of connection with them, especially in these tactics he's talking about. You really do have to have something built up with these people already before you start asking them to assist you with this new project.
Well, you hear all the time, go and provide value first before you ask other people for things. And maybe, and he mentions it, that sometimes it may just be you email them a thank you for something, for it. Maybe you had an inspiration from a post they did or a podcast or whatnot. And just by sending a thank you, because usually a lot of these people, they receive tons and tons of emails, and most of them are people asking for advice. And I know you hear all the time also, hey, if you want to build a relationship, ask people for advice because people like giving advice. But I think for people who get that all the time, it's not as valuable. So when you stand out, if you stand out a little bit by just saying thank you, that's actually the new way to stand out on top of going above and beyond by maybe providing some sort of value. But that was one of the steps he talks about. One of them also, his step number two, he says, act like a pro. Kind of, I guess it's like that fake it till you make it type thing. I've never understood that or how you do it. Have you ever been in a situation where you had to fake something and I guess it like turns out good for you in the end because you faked it? I guess I don't. Yeah, I don't really agree with that type of thing, because I don't
see. I do, and this is something that I did a lot in the real estate game when I got into it. Because to be honest, anytime you're in one of these environments where you're surrounded by a lot of experienced people, if you just go in there and you say, hey, I'm new, help me. Well, a lot of times there's going to be some helpful people, but most of the time people kind of see you as somebody that's just getting in their way or slowing them down, or why would they want to help you if they have something successful going? And there's obviously givers out there that are willing to help. But if you're really trying to integrate yourself in this group or in this community, sometimes you do have to kind of act like you belong. And you're not going to lie if someone says, hey, are you new at this? Have you ever done this before? Sure, you can go ahead and admit, yeah, you know, I'm not as experienced as most of the people around me. But if you just walk in and kind of act like you belong, a lot of times people will just treat you like you belong, and you can learn through osmosis as opposed to having to be taught. And a lot of people, admittedly, learn better as they're doing versus learning from, you know, a book or learning from reading blog posts or something like that. And how he talked about here, he just acted like a pro. Sometimes he didn't feel like he belonged, but he just acted like he belonged. And that was a huge step for him. And I can totally relate to that.
Does acting like a pro mean you have to say, for example, if he's reaching out to some of these A-list names, does he have to make them think that his audience is bigger than it really is, or he gets more downloads for a show than he really does? Is that what he's talking about, or is it more just like kind of a confidence type thing? Because that's what I feel like when people say act like a pro, you kind of have to lie a little bit. And you see it all the time, especially on online type stuff, people kind of inflating their numbers, their revenue or whatnot, maybe even their lifestyle. They inflate it to make it seem like it's more glamorous than it really is. And I just find that a little disingenuous. And
I don't think there's anything disingenuous about this method. Sure, anybody can lie. You can go in there and lie, but I don't think that's acting like a pro. I think it's more what you talked about in terms of acting confident. If he's reaching out to these big name entrepreneurs and asking them to contribute to his journal, he's composing a very well thought out, a very professional email to them and practicing some of the tactics that people talk about, you know, getting to the point, not wasting a lot of the person's time with filler. He's doing all these things just like a pro would. So he might not be a pro, but he's acting like one. He's not coming out and saying, hey, I have 30,000 email subscribers that are going to be buying this and making it super successful. He's not going to say that. But if you come out and craft an email like you do it and you have done it and you know what you're doing, that's what he means by acting like a pro.
Well, maybe he has some tips about that, because I feel like a lot of people, they take, like I mentioned, a lot of people take that as I have to somewhat manipulate people to think our audience, our downloads are bigger than they really are. And I think, and we've had this conversation before, if people think that we get thousands of downloads a day, should we say, no, we don't do that. We don't get thousands of downloads a day. Or should we just kind of be like, yeah.
Okay. I don't think it matters. If people ask us what our numbers are, we don't lie about it. And they're not small. We see a lot of people with smaller numbers, but I would say our numbers are just a little above average. But that's not even the point. The point is, if people come to us and say, wow, your show provides us a lot of value, I learned something, or something you guys talked about gave me that light bulb in my head that, you know, I didn't realize something was right in front of me, and now because you guys were talking about it, it helped me. So in that case, they don't care what our audience is. They feel like what we provide is worth $1 million or whatever for them, even if it's not a $1 million show. So that's what matters. And if you're going to, you know, we act like we're doing this professionally, regardless of whether we are or not. So I feel like that value we provide is just as valuable regardless.
Well, I'll have to ask Tom about that, because I'm sure being confident, I feel like there's a little bit, like when you say act like a pro, you could say, oh, it's just being confident. But I feel like there's more to it. Maybe there's some tactical advice to that. But we can dig into a lot more of these later on. You can go to his site. We'll link it up below. Go and read some of these. It's a good sized post, so it may take you a little bit. But he has some good tips, especially with connecting with some of the bigger names and what you can do, and maybe even translate that into building a product out of it. But for now, we're just going to get to Tom in the main event.
It's time for the main event.
For the main event today, we have Tom Morcus. Tom started out jumping out of helicopters as an Iraqi war vet to jumping into the cutthroat publishing industry, recently starting Insurgent Publishing. He also started the In the Trenches podcast and a huge proponent of the controversial customer pays what they want for products. Tom, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Guys, Dan and Joe, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, you told us before we recorded, but tell the audience where you're hanging out right now.
Yeah, I mean, not to rub it in or anything, but I am in Gili Air, Indonesia, which are these small little islands off of Lombok, which is just east of Bali. So it's if you've ever seen the movie The Beach with Leonardo DiCaprio, it's like that, but not quite as trippy.
Yeah, Tom, I haven't even heard of that place, and you're hanging out there. Jeez.
That's it, man.
Love it. But well, before we dive into one of your recent pieces of content, is there a recent podcast you've been on that you tell your backstory really well?
Yeah. You know, actually, I've been in a couple recently. The show Suitcase Entrepreneur with Natalie Sisson. I was on hers, and I go into my backstory a little bit of West Point and the Army, and so people can hear about that if they're interested.
Love it. Well, we appreciate your service. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we're going to dive into your recent piece, How I Enlisted the Help of Stephen Pressfield and a Dozen Other A-Listers to Bring My Vision to Life. And you had just started Insurgent Publishing, and you release The Creative Entrepreneur, and you have it as a pay-as-you-want model. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. So for something like this, is the strategy behind it to bring all these A-listers on and they basically do the promotion for you? Is that the strategy you were hoping when you started it?
Actually, that's a great question, because there was always that that part of it to a degree. Not that the A-listers would necessarily promote it, but that the people I got to contribute would be primary means of word-of-mouth marketing. So that each one of these people who contributed, whether they have an audience of five people or five, you know, 500,000, maybe like Stephen Pressfield or something like that, he might have more, that they would be able to reach out to their audience and let them know about the journal. And that's it. I'm not, you know, I never asked anybody to really, you know, promote the hell out of it or anything like that. But yes, that was part of it, was I wanted to get people on board who would be willing to share it with their audiences. So that helped with word of mouth marketing for my journal.
Is that a strategy that a lot of people should be employing? Should they all be hitting up Pat Flynn and John Dumas and the like to get them in on group projects? Or is that something, I know you talk about in the post that you built a relationship with them. Is that something that you have to be building a relationship for a long time? Or what's the timeline in that sort of relationship on building a product together?
Again, you know, a really great question. And the truth of the matter is, this vision for this journal only came about really last fall, back in around September of 2013. And we just launched our first journal this January. And so we have it comes out twice a year, every 6 months. So I'm working on the second one already for release in July. But it's interesting. Now that I've had, I guess I'll say this, now that I've had those kind of guys join, these kind of A-listers join and contribute to the first one, I'm now able to leverage their names to get other contributors that may have that I may not have established a relationship with, who would normally maybe blow me off and not know, okay, this guy might be an amateur, why have I not heard of him yet? But now they can see the list of people who contributed to this first one and the amount of success it has. So I'm absolutely going to leverage that group of people that I've gotten to contribute to this. So that's one part of it. But as far as like, should anybody else be using this model? I don't see why not. I think the concept of, you know, leveraging, we're building relationships with people, one, is you should be doing no matter what. And you should be doing it long before you ever need to. And that's one of the, you know, kind of catch-22s almost of, not really catch-22, it's just one of the caveats to building relationships. You build them when you don't need them, because when you do need them, that's when you need to have had built them. But if you wait till you need to have the relationship to use it, I hope this isn't too confusing, and you try to build it then, it's too late. Like, it's already too late. You got to do this stuff way before.
Well, Tom, we're definitely going to get into some of that relationship building and then leveraging those relationships to kind of help build products or whatever it is. But I want to ask you, because we had this discussion off the air, and I think it's a somewhat valuable discussion to have on the air, because a lot of our listeners, they're bloggers or they write ebooks, or they're maybe looking to become a published author, whether it's an online, you know, digitally published or, you know, fully published. And we were talking about the difference between an ebook and maybe a Kindle book and a journal. Can you maybe, because you've kind of delved into all these different areas, can you explain the differences and why it's important that what you're doing right now is a journal and not something else?
Yeah, again, this is like, it seems like such a small point, but the impact can be dramatic on somebody's revenue and impact. The fact of the matter is, we can't control how people perceive certain things, whether we like to or not. So if I write the best ebook in the world, I can only realistically price that thing at maybe like $10. And that's just the nature of how Amazon has essentially price anchored, you know, the price of a book at about $10. And that's actually probably for an established author. But for an independent author, for a self-publisher, well, I can't sell for $10. People are going to ignore my book. So I'd have to drop my price maybe to like $5, maybe $4.99. But realistically, even that might be cutting it. That might be too high. So I'd have to drop it even more. So all of a sudden, I'm in this race to the bottom, which I believe that's a term that Seth Godin uses a lot. So if I'm trying to release an ebook and I'm trying to make money from it and live off my ebooks, I'm in a losing battle, really, in terms of I have to continue to drop my price all the way down to maybe 99 cents. Maybe I can sell, you know, a ton of copies at 99 cents. And it's just like, it's not a good position to be in. So I have a publishing company I just started. That's what we released. It's called Insurgent Publishing. We just released Creative Entrepreneur. It's just one of the projects we're working on. But I'm also working with a couple authors on their books. And so they are writing books. But the importance of how you release and how you present it is, it's the difference between making a lot of money and making none. And it has to do with these words that we use. So an ebook is, again, it's anchored at around $1 to $10. But a guide is not. A guide could sell for anywhere from, I don't know, $30 to maybe a few hundred dollars. If it's a really important guide, has a lot of useful information in it. Or how about an exclusive report? I've seen exclusive reports in real estate and stocks trading that sell for thousands of dollars. So now all of a sudden, just by changing the word, even though it's the exact same thing, it's a PDF and it's got words in it, and that's it. You change the name of it and what the purpose is about it and the angle, and all of a sudden you can charge 10, 20, 30 times more. So I'm not saying don't write ebooks. I think people should write ebooks. I think people should write books. I love books. I buy books. And I'm a publisher and I plan to publish books. But I think it's an important concept to understand that the way we word things, the way we present things can have a dramatic impact on revenue.
Yeah, I agree. Because, I mean, if you think about it, someone might work just as hard and put together just as quality of a document for an ebook, you know, as they would anything else. But because they call it one thing, they could be just diminishing the value of it and killing any profitability they might have had. So that's a good way to look at it. And I've never looked at it that way, but you're absolutely right. Just by throwing that one name on there, pulling that ebook name off, it just creates a huge difference in perception.
That's exactly it. And so for the journal, I called it a journal for specific reasons. A journal might, you know, if somebody thinks of a journal, they're going to think of one or two things. They're going to think of a journal that you doodle in and maybe like write down your like thoughts like Dear Diary, which obviously this is not. The second thing they might think of is, okay, a medical journal or some kind of scientific journal. And so immediately that's going to bring thoughts of academia, like, okay, this is an academic thing. This is more academic than just a magazine, right? And then a journal is also more exclusive than a magazine. It doesn't come out all the time. It's more premium. And then the type of and publications come out for a journal publication comes out less often than a magazine. A magazine's monthly, a journal's not. So I was very particular about choosing the word journal for this, which is why it's actually pretty cool that you asked about this, because I haven't quite explained why I chose journal versus something else, versus magazine. And sometimes people mistakenly refer to it as a magazine, and it's not. It's a journal for a very specific reason, because the articles that you'll find in it are more academic. They're longer form essays in a lot of cases, and the content in it is geared towards the people that really care about learning and becoming experts in the field of entrepreneurship and business. So, and it's, again, because it's a journal, it's semi-annual. It doesn't come out every month like a magazine. So that's kind of just, you know, interesting thoughts on the angle and how we present things and the whole marketing of it.
So if you want it to be a journal and you want people to think of it that way, when people read it, what kind of feedback are you hoping to receive? Are you hoping that they say, oh, I'm writing a bunch in it and that's giving me new ideas? Or do you want them to say, oh, I didn't even hear about this person, I'm going to start following them? What's your plan behind that? When you want someone to pick it up, they think of it as a journal. What's the feedback that you're saying, okay, I hope this is what they say to us about it?
Good question. So I guess the end state of this is that I guess the best way I can do it is give analogies to types of books that I really care about, and say that I want to create the same type of impact. So books that I really care about from authors that I really care about are guys like Seth Godin and his book Poke the Box, or some of his other work. It's kind of a gut check. It's not the most in-depth stuff what he writes, but it's a gut check and it makes you think. If you think about Stephen Pressfield and The War of Art, again, it's this kind of nonfiction that's kind of, you know, pretty edgy and again, it's a punch in the gut. It makes you think twice about what you're doing, and it makes you it motivates you, but it's also in a positive way where you can actually start taking action on that. So I want people to have that reaction to it. I want them to be like, wow, this information is really powerful. It's really motivating, but not just fluffy motivational stuff. There's substance behind this. There's stuff I can take and I can execute on this. And again, my goal with this journal was I didn't want to overcrowd it with too much content. I wanted to keep the pieces very specific and very targeted and very actionable, and to keep it to maybe 10 to 12 essays. I want to say the first journal had about 12 essay contributions, about 119 pages. So it's a lot of content, but it's still not an overwhelming amount of content. But the point of it, I want people to be reading it and to stop midway through or through an article and start taking action on the principles or the frameworks or the ideas that are in the journal. So that was my goal. And so far, the feedback has been positive across the board, with some recommendations for the next journal on how to even improve on the concept. So that's what I'm going for. And so far, I'm very humbled to say that I think I've done it in terms of putting it together the right way. And I think the team that I assembled was just incredible. And the articles they put together are just amazing. And so, yeah, I'm getting that positive feedback that people are loving it, and they're putting the concepts to action. So that makes me very happy.
Cool. Well, let's look a little bit at this article, because I think a lot of people, they want to know, how can I connect more with someone and maybe get them to collaborate with me? And one of the things you talked about, you say you acted like a pro, and Dan and I, we talked a little bit about this before you came on, and there's always this, at least in my mind, there's, especially in the online world, acting like a pro, I also feel there's a little bit of manipulation as well, because you want people to think that maybe you're more successful than you really are, or your audience is bigger than it really is. But Dan doesn't think that's the case. So when you say act like a pro, what are you trying to say?
Yeah, good call. I definitely hope it doesn't come off like, pretend to be some sort of successful person that you're not. When I make a reference to act like a pro, as opposed to, some other saying, when I say act like a pro, I mean, what does a pro do? A professional, what does a professional do? How does a professional carry himself or herself? How does a professional act in these situations? Which is to say, confident, assertive, and you have a vision, and you know what the vision looks like, and you know how to get there. And so you're able to lead people. So no point did I ever say, hey, I got, a million visitors to my site, I'm super successful, I have, a ton of exposure, and this is going to, do all these great things for you. I never pretend to be anything that I wasn't. I never mentioned anything. I never said to anybody or pretended to be somebody I wasn't. But what I did, when I say I acted like a pro, I acted like the kind of person who was a publisher. So I just started my publishing company. I'd never done that before, but I figured it out as I went along. And the whole time, I tried my best to act like a professional in that industry would, which is to say, I knew what I was doing when it came to the journal. I had one, I get a lot of volunteers for different things, from editors to artists and things like that. And I had one editor come and approach me, and she had been worked on a magazine for 10 years as kind of their lead editor. So I was really excited that she was kind of interested in the project. And then she asked me my background. So I told her the vision, and I went through it with her. And I told her, I went through all that with her. She was kind of excited about it. That she asked me my background. She's like, so where, what publishing company do you work for? I was like, well, Insurgent Publishing, it's my publishing company. She's like, okay, where'd you work before that? I was like, well, I was in the Army before that. She's like, so what experience do you have in publishing? It was none. I have none. Of course, she didn't realize that at the time, because of the way I understood the material and what I was doing. There was no question in her mind that I knew what I was doing. So that, I think, is an interesting story, because I think when we start acting like pro, we act like the person we want to become, we become that, whether we like to or not. And of course, there's the whole time, the whole feeling I'm getting, as I never felt like a pro. I never felt like, oh, I'm an experienced publisher. But I acted like one anyway, even when I was uncertain, even when it was scary. I made sure that I was acting professional, and I acted like I knew what I was doing the whole time. And at the end of the day, I basically did. I winged it, sure, in some ways, but it all came together flawlessly.
It's really cool. I like the way you put that. You didn't feel like one, but you acted like one. So it's almost this internal versus external. Internally, you might have been scared, S-less, because, you're dealing with all these big name people, and you're, presenting this idea that maybe a pro would be doing. But externally, you're putting this air of you know, that you're confident and you know what you're doing. And maybe you don't have that experience, like you said, but you've done your research, you've done your due diligence, you've put in your time so that any question that a pro might be asked or any obstacle that a pro might be faced with, you're going to kind of prepared for that and put on that front. So I think that's really a good way to put it, not feeling like one, but acting like one.
Exactly. And so that's what I try to do really with everything I do. I actually, in that article you were referencing, I did a little video clip from the Boiler Room, and it's this short segment. It's about Act As If, and it's Ben Affleck's best role, I think. And he's talking to a room full of stockbrokers, and he's saying, act as if. He's like, act as if you're, you know, act as if you're the man. Act as if you're, you know, you have $1 million in your pocket. Act as if, you know, you're the best broker in the world. And it's,
I think he says a few other things there, Tom, but I want to keep it PG.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. Anyway, it's really, I love that. I love that scene. It's really powerful for me because it's true. I think when you start, you say to yourself, yeah, you know, I don't have to have this crazy track record. If I just start acting the part, which is very different than, again, I guess it's a fine line between acting, like you know what you're doing, and then deceiving someone, which was never the intention. If anybody asked me how much experience I have, I'd be willing to tell them zero. And now at this point, though, I can say, yeah, I published a journal successfully, and I'm publishing these other things successfully. So now, as I started to do this, one of the other things I mentioned in that article was start before you're ready. I started before I was ready. I had no experience in this, but now I do. Now I'm ready for the next issue. Now I'm ready for what comes next. So now I in a matter of speaking, now I kind of am the pro that I pretended to be, that I acted as if I was, if that makes sense.
But how do you overcome that, I guess, insecurity when that lady asked you, so how many years experience do you have, or what type of publishing do you have? And you say, well, I have my new publishing company I just started. And you know you're just starting off and you have no experience. How do you overcome that insecurity that I'm being judged right now because I'm pretty much revealing that I don't know too much about the publishing industry? Maybe I know it in theory, I've read it, but I haven't had the experience yet. How do you overcome that insecurity?
Again, good question. And I guess I've never had, maybe it's one of my natural talents or natural disposition, is I've never necessarily been really afraid of people's perceptions of me. It's never really mattered at all to me at all, like whatsoever. Which, so I guess you could say that's confidence. I don't know. Maybe it's confidence. Maybe it's cockiness. I don't think I'm cocky, but I think there is a certain level of confidence, and I take with me no matter what I do. And it's kind of the same confidence. It's a confidence in myself and my abilities. So I had this vision, and I knew I was going to bring it to life. And so you got to think about it in those terms. Like, think about that. If you're so dead set on something, you're going to make it happen. Who can stop you? You know what I mean? If you know you got it, and you know you're going to put it together. No matter how far-fetched it might seem, if you're committed to it, you personally, in your own heart, like in your soul, you know you're committed. You know, who cares what people say and what they think of it? If they think you're unprepared, you know you're committed to it. I think that kind of internal, I guess you could call it internal game or whatever you want to call it, that kind of internal confidence, that's what keeps me motivated and keeps me moving. Even when things were confusing or I didn't know what was going on or I was trying to like figure things out as I went along. And there were a million questions I had to ask and answer and be humble about and learn as I went. But I knew at the end of the day, no matter what, I was going to ship this thing on January 1st. And I did. And that's period. You know what I mean? So everything came together. I hustled it. Yeah, I learned it as I went. But I think that's it. That's how you deal with that kind of insecurity. You say, okay, you know what? Screw whatever anybody else thinks. I'm committed to this. I'm going to make this happen. And you just reflect on that. And that's what you focus on no matter what. And you constantly ask yourself, not questions like, do people take me seriously? Or do people, whatever. You know, who cares what people think? But you ask yourself, what do I do next to make this happen? What's the next step to make sure I execute this as perfectly as I can?
Well, yeah. Plus, you spent years jumping out of large vehicles in the sky. So, I mean, let's be honest. Asking, talking to a publisher is not the biggest thing in the world.
Yeah. I guess I'm blessed with that background then. And that having been what I've been through, yeah, it's kind of like, really? Like, it's not that intimidating to me. So, yeah, that's a bonus. So, if anybody wants to boost their confidence, you could try that out, maybe. Maybe that'll be a confidence booster for you. Start jumping out of airplanes or helicopters or whatever.
There you go. Bonus tip from Tom there. But so what I want to get into now is something you talked about, how, you know, how you built these connections and how you decided who to reach out to because of those connections you built. And it seems like almost you built connections too well, because you said you put out this call to action to all these entrepreneurs and your feedback was overwhelming. You thought you might have a lower success rate in terms of who was going to write articles for you for the journal. So I want to know, if you got, you know, inundated with all these essay submissions, how did you kind of sort through who's going to get cut? And bigger picture, how did you communicate to these, you know, quote unquote, big name entrepreneurs that they were getting cut from your journal?
Yeah. Good question. So yeah, because when I first had the idea, one of the first things I did to kind of quickly validate the idea was I sent out messages about the concept and about what I was doing and kind of general idea of the vision. And I posted it on a lot of different Facebook groups that I'm part of and a lot of different masterminds, whether it's a smaller masterminds I was a part of, but also larger groups, any membership sites I was a part of. So a bunch of different mediums I put it out on and shared it with people that I kind of knew. They might recognize my face on Facebook or whatever. Or I might have helped them out at some point. So put it out there for a lot of people. So the response was overwhelming, probably by a lot of people that, you know, so the response was overwhelmingly positive. So I put it out there real quick. When I put it out there, I had no idea what the response was going to be. There might have been crickets. And if there had been crickets, I might have taken a second look at this idea for a journal. I might have said, okay, maybe this isn't the route I go. But because I got such a resounding positive response and started getting emails, yes, I want to contribute. Yes, I want to contribute. And I got maybe, you know, 30 or 40 of those like confirmations. Yes, I want to. Like, I want to be a part of this. Within the first couple of days of me putting this stuff out there. So I was like, well, that's, if 40 people write a journal or journal articles for me, that's more than enough for the first journal. You know, I'll have to cut a lot of those. So the interesting part is I put it out there. I got a resounding response to it. But of course, you might be thinking, well, how do you get somebody like Stephen Pressfield? Stephen Pressfield isn't hanging out on those Facebook forums. He's writing books. Pat Flynn, same deal. He has his own forums or his own kind of like groups that he's a part of, but he doesn't respond very often. You kind of had to send the direct messages. So for guys like them, I sent direct messages. I was like, these are the people I would like to get a part of this, be a part of this. And I had spent, and I wanted them to be a part of it because I'd spent time with them and I respected what they did. And so I established relationships with them. For Pat Flynn, I knew him, you know, for the last couple of years, and I went and met him in person at a meetup he had in Nashville. Stephen Pressfield, I met years ago, and I've had an email conversation going with him ever since. On and off a little bit, like, but over the course of years, like, he knows my name, maybe he does. He seemed to recognize me when I emailed him for the request. So it's interesting though. So once I did that, when it came time, when I actually received the contributions, I realized pretty quickly, again, I was learning all this as I was going along, that publishing is hard work, in that a lot of people aren't the best writers. So people wrote stuff and I was like, wow. So I'm glad I got a positive response, but I got a lot of essays that were like rough around the edges. So I had to be the guy to say, okay, here's my producer's edit. Take it back to the drawing board, rework it. And I had to do that for everybody. Pretty much every contribution you see in there was reworked probably at least once, which is impressive in my mind. And that it didn't matter if they were a big name, like John Lee Dumas. I was like, hey, man, can you go back and rework this and take it from this angle? Can you give me more material here? And he was cool with it, you know? And that's part of it. Part of acting like a pro is I'm not just going to take something that they give me because they have a big name and say, okay, this is good, you know, publish it. That I have to be that voice to say, as a curator and as a, you know, editor, to say, you know, maybe this isn't good enough, take it back to the drawing board. So yeah, it was quite the process. Did I answer your question there? Because I know we've been talking for a
minute. Yeah, you absolutely did.
Cool.
No, that's exactly what I was wondering. So something else I'm wondering though is, what was your initial approach to these people? Because I know you had a great idea, obviously, because of the response you got. Everyone liked the idea. But, you know, kind of tactically, what was your, you don't have to give us like the email that you sent to them, but what were kind of the key points that you wanted to hit? And what was kind of the structure of your email so that you got to the point, didn't waste their time, and really felt like you communicated your message? Because a lot of people maybe have these great ideas and maybe even have these connections, but they're not sure how to send that email actually pitching their idea.
Yeah, so I'll take a step back and say, when I first put the idea out there, I did it on these larger group forums and Facebook groups and things like that, because I wanted validation quickly, and sending out individual emails was not the fastest way to validate it. So by putting it out in group forums, so tactic number one, validate with a large audience first if you can. A large but specific demographic, if that makes sense. So, you know, as opposed to like direct emails, I can touch on that in a second. I think direct email is the most powerful thing you could do. Well, I guess next to having a conversation in person or a phone call. But sending it out, getting the quick validation on Facebook groups and different forums like that was how I validated the idea very quickly. And when I put it out there, at first, I had no idea necessarily what form this journal would take. I just had this kind of idea in my head, and that's it. So I tried to describe it as best as possible. When I first put it out there, I had no idea that I'd tie it into charity. I had thought about charity, but I just wasn't sure how. So I didn't mention much about charity. So I had all these different ideas like that were not concrete at all. But I put it out there, just an idea. And again, that idea, when I fleshed it out, it was just, here's an idea for a premium business journal. I want to hear your stories. I want it to be very personable. I want it to be very, in-depth. I want these to be almost academic. And so that was kind of the idea. I got a positive response from it. When I got those responses back, okay, I was like, okay, what's the next step? I have to kind of actually form this journal into something. So that took a lot of creative energy to figure out what is this journal going to look like. And so I just went through iteration after iteration of like sketches and ideas. And I was like, okay, I think I have something here I'm going to work with. And that's when the idea of charity, intermixing charity into the mix, or putting charity into the mix and using a pay what you want model. I love pay what you want anyway. So I figured, why not? I teach pay what you want all the time. Why not use it for my first publishing company initiative? Not to, put myself into a corner here and be the guy that only uses this option. But I thought it was a perfect fit for this journal, was to give people the chance to contribute whatever they want, make it donation-based, and give profit to charity up to 100%, depending on what the person donating chooses. So all these things kind of came over time. So once I had this idea of like, okay, combining it with charity, then when I started sending direct emails, I mentioned that. So I mentioned it, to Pat Flynn. I said, hey, here's my vision of what I'm doing. Well, first I said, hey, I'm going to get it particular because I think this is important for people to hear. I said, hey, Pat, Tom Work is here. I don't know if you remember, but we met back in, this date back in Nashville at your meetup. Thank you so much for doing that. So I mentioned that I met the guy in person. I've been listening to his podcast. I promote his work. I probably even sent him an email. I probably linked to an article that I mentioned him in where I wrote about him and promoted his stuff. So all of a sudden, I'm a guy who, he knows me. I met him before. I've been following for a while. I promote his work. Okay, he might take a few seconds to listen to me, right? So then that's when I came in with a pitch. I mentioned, okay, here's my vision for what I'm doing here. If I had, and at the time, I had some people on board. And so I said, here's the big names I already have on board. And here's who I'm looking to get on board. So again, I'm kind of name dropping, but in a very specific tactical way, because I want him to take me seriously. So I did name drop when I had confirmation that people were going to be on board. And then finally, I gave the pitch. I said, hey, I don't need a ton from you. I just want you to, answer these questions or whatever it was. So depending on what I wanted out of people, I'd be very specific about how they could help and also give them an out so that they can get out of it. They don't have to commit to it now, or I can come back and give them something easier to commit to later, if that makes sense. So that was kind of the tactical level stuff I used.
So did the publishing company result because you published this book and then you realized that you enjoyed it, or was it the other way around?
No, it was the other way around. I had had the idea to start a publishing company about a year ago, probably 6 months after I started writing online and having some success self-publishing, and realizing that I love bringing my own ideas to life, but I also love helping other people bring their ideas to life, especially in like book form and stuff like that. And so I was like, well, there's so many brilliant people I meet every day who have a great story to tell, and I think they just need a good kick in the butt to get that story out there and then the right way and to make it beautiful, make those ideas beautiful on paper and on the digital screen. And so I can do that. So the whole premise around Insurgent Publishing was to be that kind of boutique publishing company that caters to a specific niche. In this case, we cater to creatives and to entrepreneurs, and we create cutting-edge, unconventional nonfiction for these kind of creative outliers. And so the journal was just, so that was the initiation of the publishing company. It started in 2013 as just an idea, and I put together the framework for it, and I got authors on board. So I have a couple authors I'm getting ready to publish this year. But back then, they had just had the idea for a book, right? So books take a long time. So I was like, well, what can I do in the meantime? Well, I can get somebody to write an article, right? I can get somebody to write an essay. That doesn't take too much time, and I can edit those essays and put them together. So the journal was just my reaction to, I have this publishing company, I've got authors on board, but I have to wait for their content to finish. So what can I do in the meantime? Well, I could do maybe a semi-annual journal. It was just, I have no, it's so funny because I say, and I listen to my own story now, I'm like, I was just kind of winging it the whole time. But now I'm very happy with the results, and I'm going to keep going forward with this journal. The next issue is going to be even better. I'm really excited about it. And it's kind of opened my, you know, world up to like this, these possibilities. But it's just kind of cool when you think about it that you don't need to have it all figured out at first. You just kind of take it one step at a time, one day at a time, and you just build off that. So for, if that answers your question, I started with the idea of the publishing company and I kind of did the journal to fill in the gap between the books that I'm getting ready to publish with these authors.
So would you say, are you competing against people who are just going on CreateSpace, writing something, putting it on Amazon? Are you trying to face off against them, or are you more for the people who keep saying they're going to go on CreateSpace and put it on Amazon, and instead they go to you and you kind of coach them or help them out in a certain way, and you get a cut of their book once they release it?
Good question. It's interesting because, and this could be a naive thing of me to say this, but I perceive it as I have zero competition in terms of I don't actually perceive competition, because I'm certainly not competing against big publishers. I'm not. I just don't have the resources to compete with them, so I'm just not. And because I have a very specific demographic that I'm catering toward, I don't really have to worry about many people in the space. But here's the cool part. I actually encourage people to self-publish. I write about self-publishing and try to help people self-publish. If somebody wants to self-publish, I'll help them. Like, I say that again and again. Like, even if they don't want to go through my publishing company, I'm happy to help them bring their idea to life. What my publishing company does, though, is it provides, professional level edits and artists and the whole nine yards of professional services you would get from a big publishing company without the hassle of like trying to get a publishing contract and then getting only like 5% of every book sale. Like, it's ridiculous, right? But because I'm boutique, because I'm working with, independent authors here, and because all my stuff is very little overhead and I designed it that way in particular, I can focus all my, time and effort and the people I have in my company right now to focus on creating like the best possible product for at margins that no publishing company can match. So I'd say right now, give or take, just to be very frank with you, right now we give 50% of net receipts to the artist, and then we take 50% of net receipts, which is to say if I sell something on Amazon might take a 30% cut. Of the remaining 60, it's 50-50. And so what you'll find is it's a really cool way to be basically partners with the author, him or herself. So it's kind of a unique take, and there's no publisher that gives 50% a profit. It's insane, and there's just nothing like that out there. So as far as the person we're targeting, I'm looking to target the person who's probably read some of my stuff and kind of is already part of my audience to come forward and be like, I like your vision on things, and I like how you put things together, and I want to work with you on this. And so that's how I've got my first initial batch of authors on board. Was they'd heard me speak or write, and they mentioned they were writing a book. I said, well, hey, I have a publishing company. These are the things we provide. If you'd like to, these are the terms, general terms. We can work through it and figure it out what works best for you. But that's what I bring. So what I bring is that creative vision and then the coherent professional package to make their ideas beautiful and then to market it and sell it directly to the niche that they care about.
Do they have to do the pay what you want model, or is that just for you?
No, absolutely not. They don't have to. So that's kind of one of the, part of the strategy. We do strategy sessions, of course, too. And it's like, what's your goal with this book? So I have an author that's getting ready to, who reached out to me after listening to my podcast, realized he was a combatives instructor at West Point when I was at West Point. And I don't believe I actually had him as one. But it's funny. It's just funny how these paths cross, right? So he saw that I was a West Pointer, he saw these things I'd done, he saw what I was writing online, he was getting ready to write and self-publish a book. I was like, well, here's what I'm doing, if you're interested. And he was like, absolutely, because he liked my vision, he liked the things that I did. So we're working together on his book right now. So for him, it's a matter of, okay, who's he trying to reach with his book? His book is on essentially high performance and high stress environments, because he teaches like combatives to army personnel, to special forces, to SWAT teams. So he trains with all these elite level high performers under high stress environments, right? So he's writing a book on that. How do you perform? How do you create high performance in high stress environments, right? So that's, again, we have that topic. Okay, now who do we want to target? We want to target athletes, and we want to target coaches, and we want to target, really, I want to target into a broader demographic anybody that competes in a high stress environment, which could be entrepreneurs, could be business owners, could be CEOs. So we think about that, and then that's how we tie together the package, how we're going to sell it, what we're going to price it at, what, things like that. So no, just pay what you want is just one of those tools we can use if we want to. In his case, I don't know if we will. We might approach it that way, but I don't see a need to. So if that makes sense. So it's interesting. Each thing, each book, each project has its own angle and aspect to it, and you have to take those into consideration when it comes to the marketing and who you're targeting and what impact you're trying to create.
Love it. So what's the next piece coming out from Insurgent Publishing, or are you just right now promoting the creative entrepreneur right now? Is that your main focus at the moment?
Yeah, I'm definitely promoting the heck out of the creative entrepreneur, which means everybody listening should go and buy it and donate to a good cause. But no, beyond that, though, although I truly believe in that. And that's the cool part about the creative entrepreneurs. It's, you know, since it's a annual donation-based project, I can continue to promote it all year round and get new subscribers, which is really exciting. But as far as our next projects, I have that one from Jason Winkle, who I just mentioned. Jason Winkle, excuse me. And so that's the next book that we're tentatively getting ready to release in March. So it's a little bit of flex right now, and we're getting ready to start rolling out some of the promotion for that. And I have some other things that are kind of more, top secret, G14 classified that I'm working on. We'll roll out a little bit later in the year.
Well, since you just said go out and buy it, it is a pay what you want model, but is that how you present it to people? You say go buy it. Is there some is there a psychological thing going on there? I guess that's my own curiosity.
No, I was just winging that. I was just saying, hey, go check it out. Actually, it's really what I should have said is go contribute. Get the journal and go contribute to a good cause, because that's the point of it. It's donation based. We give a portion of the proceeds, up to 100%, to Kiva.org to facilitate microloans to entrepreneurs in developing countries. So it like really ties really well into the theme of the journal, which is all about entrepreneurship. So yeah, as far as psychological tactics there, no, I just try to appeal to idealism, and hopefully that idealism gets people to go and contribute. But it starts at $1 per issue, so $2 per year, and you can have this excellent journal. And I encourage people to just go get it for $2 a year. I'm happy with that. Like, every dollar really does make an impact. And I know some people think that, well, $2 is not worth my time to contribute, but it does. It really, really does make an impact. So if people are interested, go check it out.
Has in your experience, if you have a donate button to like a special cause, if they pay, then some of it proceeds to a charitable cause. Have you seen that brings in more donations, or it's just pretty much the same both ways?
Yeah, when it comes to pay what you want, actually, when you integrate donation into a pay what you want concept, it can in some studies, in some research studies, they tested that to see what the results would be, and in more than one example, it showed that when you included charity into the mix of a pay what you want product, that revenue increased dramatically, sometimes more than double. So yeah, there's a strategic aspect to this too. Obviously, I want to increase my revenue and get this stuff and make enough revenue to make this company self-sustaining. Cash flow is, as you guys know, cash flow is the number one most important factor for any startup. You have to get to positive cash flow as fast as possible. That's what the whole lean startup concept is. So I wanted to do that. And I thought to myself, well, I want to be a philanthropic anyway. I'm doing pay what you want. The best thing I can do is congruently associated with a charity. And so that's why Kiva.org is like a miracle for me, because I didn't know who I was going to integrate it with. I thought of a bunch of other charities. I reached out to a lot of charities to see if they'd interested. And then I stumbled upon Kiva. I was like, this is a no-brainer for this journal. It just makes perfect sense. So yeah, so there's not only like a philanthropic aspect to it, but there's a strategic aspect from my company as well, that if I tie this into charity, it'll increase revenue. And yeah, across the board, that's been true. People are more willing to pay a lot more for a donation-based model when a portion or all of it goes to charity. The cool part is I give the user the chance to contribute however much they want to charity. So if they want to contribute 100% of what they pay to charity, they can. They can just type it in. Or if they want to contribute zero, they can do that too. So I've had some people contribute, 100% to charity, and some people contribute 5 or 0%. It's set at 10% automatic right now. But that's the cool part. Like, it's like however you feel good about it, good about yourself for donating. I want to inspire that kind of generosity in people, and so I think I'm doing a good job with that so far, at least based on the results I've gotten and the response.
Excellent. Well, Tom, we appreciate you coming on. Everyone, go check out The Creative Entrepreneur. Donate a little to charity. We appreciate that. Tom, where can we go and find out about you?
Yeah, for sure. The journal, you can find it at insurgentpublishing.com, and you can also sign up and be a part of the subscriber list there, as we'll be rolling out new books pretty soon. And I always make sure to give special incentives to subscribers, just as a thank you, for being a subscriber. So I started publishing to check out the journal and some other books that I'm publishing. And then TomMorkes.com, TomMorkes.com, to kind of get inside my brain and see what I think about startups, business, entrepreneurship, creativity, and things like that.
Sweet. Well, thanks, Tom. We appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Joe and Dan. Appreciate it, guys.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love it if you join us every Monday morning to hear the latest episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast. Remember, the place to go to find the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more is www.entrepreneurshowdown.com. And while you're there, leave us your email address to find out about upcoming guests, latest episode releases, and a whole lot more.